Can you define capital in the Austrian way? Here's a hint. It's flow and not a stock. Intangible, not tangible. But it can be appraised, and smart entrepreneurs use capital appraisal to manage their revenue growth and profits. Professor Matthew McCaffrey is here to help us.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are economic heroes. They improve others' lives with preferred products and services, innovation, and value. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hey, Hunter Hastings here. In our Economics for Business project, we urge entrepreneurs to think better by thinking Austrian. One of the ways to do this is to see things differently. Visualize economics in a different way, using mental maps and models that aren't the same as in the past. An old folding map of Paris is no substitute for Google Maps or Waze, and seeing things differently can lead to new clarity. One of the ways we've tried to accomplish this task is to see markets as a dynamic process, an ever-changing ecosystem of customers and their preferences, choices and trade-offs, one which entrepreneurial businesses must reflect and fit into by proactively initiating change themselves, never locking into a set of capabilities or a value proposition that's inflexible. This dynamic vision is very different than the business school model of fixed markets divided into market share blocks or consumer populations divided into static segments. If you can visualize dynamism and continuous change, you can be better at organizing for it and managing it. Today, we have another iconoclastic visualization that stems from the dynamic Austrian view of the market, and one we think can be very helpful in managing constant change. The subject is capital. When you think of capital, what do you see? A stock of money capital from a VC or a bank loan or in reserve? Do you see capital goods and all the tangible assets on your balance sheet? Do you see intellectual property? Do you see human capital? Austrian entrepreneurs see none of these in their visualization of capital. They see a flow coming into their business. It's a flow of consumer value, expressible in dollars, pounds, rubles, or whatever currency you calculate it in. It flows because they have facilitated a value experience for the consumer, one the consumer is delighted to pay for. Is it a trickle or a stream or a raging river or a tidal wave? Is it consistent and reliable, or could it change in a moment? Hint, it could always change in a moment. Capital is an inbound flow. That's why many digital businesses enjoy significant stock market valuations, valuations of their capital flow, irrespective of their hard assets and even their current profitability. There are also capital goods, of course, a totally different concept. Capital goods are items the entrepreneurial business puts into place to generate the consumer value streams. Capital goods are like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, to be combined in a way that generates the best value flow coming into the business. Which are the pieces most responsible for value flow? Which of the pieces generate no value flow and can be discarded? Which are generating less value flow than others and can be replaced or substituted in a new capital goods combination? These are some of the questions that the Austrian way of seeing things generates. Today, we are joined by a rigorous Austrian thinker and expert on capital and everything associated with capital, such as investment project appraisal. He contributed a brilliant chapter on investment appraisal to our ebook, Austrian Economics in Contemporary Business Applications. He is Matthew McCaffrey, Assistant Professor of Enterprise at University of Manchester in the UK. Professor McCaffrey, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I'm going to call you Matt from now on, if that's okay.
Of course, that's fine.
Well, thanks for helping us with our Economics for Business project. It's an exciting idea. We're creating content that we think is an improvement on standard business school teaching based on the better and more valuable and useful thinking that's available by the Austrian School of Economics. We're not being disrespectful to business schools. We just think there's some understanding here for entrepreneurs that is helpful. And today, you're going to help us by talking about capital and its role in entrepreneurial business building. And the place to start is, you said that one of the flaws or issues, let's say, don't be too negative, of the business school model is to use somewhat imprecise and confusing definitions of capital. You said the term can sometimes mean anything and everything, including, as we'll cover later, erroneous metaphors for capital, like human capital, social capital, and so on. So let's begin by having you explain this imprecision in the definition of capital.
Sure thing. Well, there are two types of problems, I think, that you tend to see in discussions of the idea of capital. So on the one hand, you have this problem where, especially in the business school context, the problem of the definition or the meaning of capital is that there really isn't one. So you have this problem, and especially in management disciplines like entrepreneurship and strategy, you have this problem where capital actually doesn't really get talked about a whole lot. As important as it has been in economics for centuries, it really doesn't have a lot of presence in certain management disciplines. Now, in others, for instance, like finance, you will see some discussion of different types of capital to mean different, referring to different kinds of amounts of money used for investment purposes or to reflect the monetary value of certain assets in a firm and this kind of thing. But in a lot of the areas that Austrians tend to focus on, like entrepreneurship and strategy, capital as such doesn't get discussed a whole lot. And when it does get discussed, it's used in a very kind of loose way, sometimes so loose that it could mean just any old amount of money that an entrepreneur might have lying around, or any fund that's available for investment or something like that. But very often, the real problem is that capital just isn't very present in a lot of management literature in the way that maybe it should be. Now, of course, there is an enormous literature on resources. So this is a concept that's absolutely everywhere in entrepreneurship and in strategy. And a lot of this has to do with the success of the so-called resource-based view of the firm, which has really brought resources to the forefront in all kinds of management research for the past few decades. But the trouble with resources is that it tends to be a notoriously slippery concept. It can be very vague and it can include all kinds of physical, financial, human assets, really anything or everything. And in fact, some literature even wants to include all kinds of entrepreneurial actions and functions under the umbrella term of resources within a firm. So this is quite a difficult problem because it kind of hints that maybe there's some other concept that we should be looking at that would allow us to disaggregate the umbrella term resources a little bit and maybe look a little bit more closely at entrepreneurs and what they do and the way that they interact with their firms and with the various assets they have. And I would argue that that concept is capital and the related notion of capital goods, which we'll, I think, also talk about a little bit. So we can really use this some sort of unified concept of capital to explain exactly how it is that entrepreneurs do what they do every day. And I think it's a little more helpful than a lot of what gets subsumed under the label of resources. Now, you did mention already that there's this other problem too. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the problem not of not defining capital, but of defining it too much. In other words, of creating all of these new metaphorical capital concepts, whether it's the very well-known ones like human capital or less well-known and less valuable ones like spiritual capital or street capital or any of these other increasingly odd metaphors. There are many, many, many of these in economics, in the management disciplines, in the social sciences, in humanities. It's almost like a rite of passage now that a concept starts being called a type of capital. It's like a signal that you've made it in the literature. So there's this problem as well, which is the proliferation of so many really not very helpful metaphors for capital as well.
Well, I must admit, I haven't come across spiritual capital personally, but I take your word for it that exists. And You're right. We keep running across these metaphors. So let's take the Austrian stance and give us the precise Austrian definition of capital and its role in business, and then we'll talk about its utility after that.
So capital, in the Austrian view, is essentially the monetary value of all of the claims to income that a business has, right? So a business possesses various tangible and intangible productive assets, and all of the incomes from these different assets that a business is capable of producing, brought together, summed up, is its capital value, right? So capital can be thought of as this monetary value that captures all of the future incomes that a business is capable of generating, all of them summed up and discounted to the present. And the discount is important too, because it reflects the value of time and the importance of that in the valuation process. Right? Now, these values, when we talk about them, are ultimately determined by consumers, like all market values in a market economy. And really what they are in the short run is entrepreneurs' expectations about consumer values. That is how these assets initially acquire their value. And then over time, as consumers have the opportunity to sort of vote in the marketplace, they determine ultimately whether the entrepreneurs were correct or incorrect about their valuations and the prices of all of those assets and the value of the business that adjusts as a response, right? But capital ultimately is the value of all of these different sort of income streams in the business, right? And when we say that assets are capitalized, what we mean is that we try to take the present value of all of the future productivity that a business is capable of creating. We express that in monetary terms, and that's what our capital is. So I sort of said that a few different ways, but hopefully people can get the core idea about the final meaning of capital. Now, it's important to distinguish this monetary value notion of capital from what are sometimes called capital goods or production goods. Now, this is another extremely important part of economics, thinking about capital goods, but they are distinct from capital value, because capital goods are simply all of those physical goods used in production. So obviously, it's important to think about how those play into the ultimate value of the business, but they're not the same as capital in the broad sense in which we mean it, right? Because those are physical goods, whereas capital as such is a monetary value.
Professor Matt McCaffrey is giving us a new way to think about capital, with both new definitions and practical applications, such as rigorous investment appraisal, for example, to help businesses thrive. He captures much of this in his chapter in our free ebook, Austrian Economics and Contemporary Business Applications, where you'll also find similar insights and applications from 5 additional Austrian business instructors. Get it at e4epod.com/ebook. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/ebook. And now back to Professor McCaffrey. And that value has been expressed in dollars or in pounds from where you're speaking from. It's a monetary calculation.
That's exactly right. And this is all hinting ultimately at ideas that people like Ludwig von Mises talked about when they discussed the notion of economic calculation, the idea that we need to express the potential market value of all these different combinations of different capital goods. But we can't do that without some kind of common denominator, and that common denominator is a money price, right? Because without a money price, all we have is this bewildering array of different physical goods that we have, you know, sitting in piles around, but we have no way of expressing what their actual value is, right? And a money price is the only true common denominator that can perform that task in the economy.
Good. Now, let me just ask you a sub question, Matt, because we get this from our listeners all the time. They say, I hear you about these values being ultimately determined by consumers. You say that monetary value of my business's claims to income or ultimately come from consumers, but I'm in a B2B business. Should I try to look all the way to the consumer to figure out my income streams, or can I just look at my customer and calculate my income streams from my customer who might be another business? Can you shed some light on that?
I think maybe the best way to think about this is in terms of a distinction between the short run and the long run. Because in the short run, as a B2B enterprise, you're going to be the people who are going to be most directly involved in forming the prices and determining the value of your business are the people you're going to be directly engaging with. That is other businesses, right? They're going to be supplying you on one end and hopefully demanding your product on the other end, right? And so immediately, this is where price determination is going to begin. But of course, all production is ultimately destined at some point for consumption. And so that means that at somewhere in the value chain, there is a final consumer who is engaging, business to customer, right? And it is those final users of all the products, of all the businesses further up in the value chain or the supply chain, is those final consumers that ultimately determine the value of all the capital goods and all the businesses that are further up in the value chain or in the higher orders, as Carl Menger would put it. So ultimately, it's their valuations that you need to look at, because obviously, if the consumer's demand for your business customers' products disappears, they're going to stop buying from you too, right? So you have this whole series of knock-on effects as changing customer valuations are imputed back up through the entire structure of production and through all those businesses in the value chain, and ultimately changes what they're worth. So in the sort of bigger picture or longer run, depending on how you want to think about it, it really is those customers that matter, right? Even if you can't immediately see that in the short run, that is the long run, bigger picture that I think everybody needs to consider in one way or another.
Good. That's really helpful. Thank you. Let's get into theory a little bit. We're big on application of theory here, but it's good to know the theory behind it. And one of the things we love about Austrian economics is the way that the leading thinkers build on the precedence of early scholars, and we have a provenance that is really valuable in understanding the ideas of capital today. So let's just have you tell us a little bit about the history of Austrian School of Economics thinking about capital and how we got to where we are today.
Well, capital has been an important theme in Austrian economics, really, right from the beginning. Karl Menger had made some inroads into the subject in his Principles of Economics and in some of his other separate writings on capital. Unfortunately, Menger was never able to complete his planned multi-volume work on economic theory, and so he ultimately wasn't able to treat capital as extensively as he had wanted to. He did publish an important paper on capital, but revised it various times over his life, but he never really got to the final statement of the theory that he had hoped for. So that task was ultimately left to Eugen von Bumbaverk, one of his students, and Bumbaverk wrote about this much more extensively. Now, Bumbaverk did take many Mengerian insights into his own theory, but in a sense, he also went his own way. So it's not the case that he simply just, copied and pasted what Menger had done and then started adding his own ideas on it. He did take his own route to some extent. And he did add a lot to our understanding about capital and our understanding of production. But one thing where it is now generally regarded that he made a misstep was accepting what is now the standard economic definition of capital, which is the produced means of production. In other words, physical goods that we have manufactured that we then use for production. So this is the capital goods or production goods definition that I mentioned before. Bumbaverk steered in that direction and away from the value conception of capital that I had mentioned was important at the beginning. And this resulted in a decades-long dispute in economics between Bumbavrk and many, many other key figures in economics of that period. For a very long time, the nature and the meaning of capital was being debated by all of these economic heavyweights. And among these, most important are actually a group of American economists. For instance, Bumbavrk had an exchange in the economics journals with John Bates Clark, who is a name, which is a name that many people might not know, but he was one of the leading subjectivist economists in the U.S. He was the founder of a sort of Mengerian tradition in the United States that was his own. And he was also a champion of the value-based view of capital. And then probably, in my opinion, the most important advances on capital theory was made by another American economist who was influenced by Bumbavrk and by Clark, and that was Frank Albert Fetter. Now, Fetter is one of the great economic theorists, but today he's sort of like the greatest Austrian you've never heard of. Jeffrey Herbner calls him the forgotten giant, and I think that's a really apt description of him, because he was extremely important in his own era, but today he's kind of forgotten, even unfortunately, by some Austrians. But he made some really outstanding contributions to capital theory and many other core areas of economic theory. And he was also very, he knew all the Austrians. He was very friendly with them throughout his entire life, and played a pretty big role in the development of the Austrian tradition from about 1900 to 1950. But in regard to this topic, he was one of the most consistent champions of subjectivism and of the value definition of capital in economics. And in fact, he was almost sort of ruthlessly subjectivist, which is what led him to reject not just the physical goods approach to capital and to embrace the monetary value notion. But he also rejected the productivity theory of interest and embraced the purely subjective, pure time preference theory, which was then later developed by people like Mises and Rothbard and some other Austrians. And in fact, Mises and Rothbard had relied very heavily on Fetter's work, especially including in capital theory when they were developing their own treatises. So this is an area where he really deserves to be talked about a little bit more, and especially because Fetter was also an early exponent of the judgment-based approach to entrepreneurship, which we talk about a lot. But he had made some really important original contributions to that several years before other better-known people like Frank Knight came on the scene and contributed. So this is just a little summary of some of the things that were going on in the history of economics at the time capital was being debated and some of the major figures. But it's important to remember some of these contributors because they really did expand and clarify our thinking about what capital is and the different ways we use the concept in economics. So I do think Fetter deserves to be remembered for that reason. Also, just by coincidence, Fetter himself in the 1920s became quite the critic of business school teaching, although maybe not quite for the same reasons that that we would be interested. He was under the impression that business schools were basically becoming training grounds for apologists for monopoly. He thought that business school students were being trained to become good monopolists and to ignore genuine market competition. But that's just a little side note for the history of economic thought. But further, just to speak to the subject of capital, Fetter was extremely concerned with clarity, especially in economic terminology. He was very, very emphatic that our terminology always needs to be clear and we always need to reason very consistently about it. And so one of the points in which he critiqued people like Bumbavrk was that he said that they inconsistently embraced different notions of capital. Sometimes they'd use it in the sense of talking about the monetary value version. Other times they would use it in terms of talking about physical goods. And his whole point was that when you do this, when you switch back and forth without consciously even realizing it, all you do is end up confusing your theory, and you end yourself up. You put yourself in a sort of a dead end. Right? And Fetter was also very, very keen on pointing out the importance for practical business affairs of good economic theory and good economic concepts. For instance, one of the things that he was very critical of the classical economists for was basically completely developing theories that really had nothing to do with anything relating to practical business. For instance, the old-fashioned cost of production theories of value, which explain long-run market prices through the various costs of production that go into them. Federer completely rejected this out of hand because he was a subjective value theorist. But one of the reasons why he said that these theories were essentially useless was because they had nothing to do with the actual business process. The idea of costs of production, as the classical economists thought about them, had basically nothing to do with the cost that everyday entrepreneurs actually pay. So he was very interested in talking about real world prices and capital as it exists in a sense that's actually useful for business. And I think this is one more reason why it's worth remembering him and revisiting some of these older debates.
A quick note, did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Well, good. You're making a Feta fan out of me as I listen to you, Matt. So one of the things we might do after this is if you send over a couple of readings, we'll put them in the key takeaways from this episode. That sounds like it'd be really helpful. So to pick up on something you said, that Feder thought that good economic theory can be practically applied in business, let's try and make that transition to talk about the implications of Austrian thinking about capital for entrepreneurs. And for me, one of the things that I found helpful in what you said is this idea of capital as a flow and not a stock, which helps us differentiate between the value flow and the stock of capital goods. And I can visualize this idea of a flow, the value flowing from consumers in the marketplace. So let's talk about that a little bit, flow and flow versus stock.
Sure. So one issue that tends to come up in some of these discussions of capital is this distinction between the stock and the flow of capital goods. And one limitation of the idea of the stock of capital is that it's a very difficult concept to use in terms of economic calculation, right? So essentially, if you have a stock of capital, you just have this collection of heterogeneous physical assets, essentially. Right? This is very difficult or impossible to define or measure, right? Because it's a case of apples and oranges. You just have all of these different assets, and there's no real way to aggregate them or to express their value in some universal way, right? So this is why I mentioned before, this is why we need money prices. This is why money prices are the foundation of economic calculation and of the ideas of people like Mises about how that relates to planning production. Because you need some common denominator to express the value of these things. And really what I mean is the value, expressing the value of these things to consumers, right? So the stock by itself isn't very helpful, right? But when you start thinking of things in terms of a flow, things become a little bit easier to understand, and they become a little bit more, the idea of capital becomes a little bit more valuable, because you can actually talk about changes in the value of business and the origin of the value without getting hung up on talking about the physical goods and the physical productivity of a business, right? What I mean is that when you look, for example, at when you use something like the value, monetary price value notion of capital, it becomes a lot easier to understand why the value of businesses can change overnight, even when it seems like nothing really substantial is happening in the business, right? For instance, you can have a business where the stock of goods, the stock, the capital, the production goods, the plant, the machinery, and so forth, where all of that remains exactly the same from one day to the next, and yet the market value of the business, its capital value, completely disappears, right? You could have that, for instance, in a situation where consumer tastes suddenly change and the value of all of those productive assets suddenly disappears, right? Because maybe they're not very good. They can't really be produced, used to produce other things, right? They might be unique assets, something like that. So without any kind of physical change whatsoever, the market value of a business, the capital value, simply disappears overnight, right? And you can also have a different case where market value appears from seemingly from nowhere without, again, any other kind of change in underlying physical assets. So this might be the kind of case you see with, you know, Silicon Valley startups and unicorns and so forth, where a company might just have an app or even an idea for an app, but very, very few physical assets, no business to speak of, no customers. And yet they still find themselves tens of millions of dollars worth in investments. People are willing to capitalize them and to bet that these businesses are going to produce tremendous amounts of revenue in the future based on whatever the core business idea is, right? But again, this would be a change in capital value that has nothing whatsoever to do with a change in an underlying stock of capital goods, right? This to me is one reason why it's important to distinguish between the stock and the flow, because the flow ultimately connects you more to consumers and what consumers value and to entrepreneurs and to what entrepreneurs guess is going to be happening in the future. That's all reflected in the flow of capital, but it's not really reflected as well or as clearly in the notion of the stock.
This all points to me, Matt, to the one of the most important elements, I think, of Austrian economics for entrepreneurs is the dynamism of it. We're always thinking in dynamic terms. So you talked about these flows that can arise seemingly out of nothing and can then disappear when consumers change. So we're trying to value capital with a discounted present value of those future flows. But they're very, really uncertain. They're subject to change. How should the entrepreneur think about capital as a management task or a management tool if we've got this dynamism and constant change that's going on? How do we manage capital in that sense?
Well, managing capital and capital value is, as I think you hinted, a problem of uncertainty, you know, in just the same way that virtually everything entrepreneurs do is uncertain. So when you think about entrepreneurs are thinking about capital, they have to deal with this constant process of dynamic change, and in particular, what consumers think about. Because maintaining your capital value and increasing it over time is ultimately this another way of looking at the same problem of making consumers happy. That you see in other aspects of the entrepreneurial process, right? So when you're thinking about these something like the capital value or the capital flow, however you want to think about it, what you're thinking about is ultimately the whole stream of consumer preferences going out into the future, combined with all kinds of other issues like the state of technology and so forth, and all the other things that entrepreneurs need to be predicting. So this creates obviously an enormously complicated problem for entrepreneurs, because you can never really take things like capital value as a given, right? There's something that always has to be, you know, sort of judged anew every single day, and it has to play it plays a really important part in the whole entrepreneurial decision process for just this reason, because of the problem of dynamic change. Right?
Well, can we think of it a bit like stock market valuations? They're changing every second, and they're supposed to be a valuation of future revenue flows for business? Are stock market valuations a form of our Austrian approach to capital?
Absolutely, they are. So in general, we do have to assume some kind of reasonably freely operating market economy to talk about this. But yes, stock market valuations are absolutely driven by the same kind of appraisal process that you see in regular capital valuation. The thing is, people invest in stocks because they believe they'll earn a return on their investment. And the belief, that belief ultimately depends on the company's ability to produce something valuable for consumers, right? So, you know, in the long run, the price of a share, for instance, will reflect its proportion of the capital value of the business, right? Now, we never really get to the long run in economics, right? It's always just always the short one. So we never really get to that place where share prices perfectly reflect their portion of the value of the business. But what you get instead is this everyday bargaining of the stock market, right? With buyers and sellers or various entrepreneurs comparing their different forecasts and appraisals of the future productivity and the future value that will be created by businesses who are selling parts of themselves on the stock market. So obviously these kind of prices, they can wildly diverge, you know, from the value that businesses ultimately generate. But like all other prices, there is a tendency in the market economy over time, especially if the data don't change, there is a tendency for these prices to converge on converge as estimates of the portion of the total value of the business. So again, this is a sort of a long run question. As I said, we never really get there. We constantly have ups and downs, and that's why stock markets are constantly fluctuating every single day. But at its bottom, this is a process of entrepreneurs and consumers and anybody who wants to play the stock market trying to figure out what the future productivity of businesses is going to be.
Okay, Matt, I'm going to now risk the possible confusion of talking about capital goods as opposed to capital. So I think you've made it clear how different they are, but there's an important element in the Austrian discussion of capital goods that I've learned to call the heterogeneous nature of capital, which I think I understand to mean you can combine different bits of capital in different ways to generate the business flows ultimately from the consumer that we're talking about. So just help us a little bit with this idea of heterogeneity of capital goods and how it fits into our thinking about capital goods and capital.
Sure. So as I mentioned before, capital goods and production goods, they are important. It's obviously also important to keep them distinct from capital as such, but they are an incredibly important topic in their own right in economics. And the reason is that ultimately businesses will depend in one way or another on some of the physical assets or some of the production goods, right, that entrepreneurs need to use. Right? The trouble here is that we say that capital goods are heterogeneous, right? Which means just another way of saying that they're not equally serviceable in all possible uses. They're not perfect substitutes for each other. There's a term that's I think the economist Robert Solow used for the first time in talking about capital, where he called it a shmoo, and a lot of sort of mainstream economists will use what we call the shmoo theory of capital, which treats capital goods as homogeneous, right, as sort of perfectly or costlessly interchangeable. We call capital as a shmoo. Capital is like a sort of just a homogeneous blob of stuff, right? You can add to it, you can take away from it, but it's pretty much all the same stuff, right? So we can just pump lots of capital into a business or take it out or whatever. But this is in conflict with the Austrian view, which looks at capital goods as fundamentally heterogeneous. You can't substitute them perfectly for each other. They're not all good in all possible uses, right? You know, a bulldozer does not have the same uses as a computer does. They are suited for very different kinds of tasks. Okay. Now, one crucial aspect of this heterogeneity, by the way, is that a lot of it has to do with entrepreneurs' perceptions. It's not just about technological differences between goods. It's about the also about the fact that entrepreneurs have very different ideas about how to combine all of these different goods and how to fit them together. Entrepreneurs have very different perceptions of, for instance, the lowest cost way to produce. They have very different ideas about which combinations of capital goods are going to produce the most value for consumers in the future, right? So entrepreneurs have these very different views on this, and it's for this reason that entrepreneurs are willing to pay often very different prices for these factors, right? And so this is one explanation of the constant changes that you see in, for instance, capital goods markets. And it's another reason why money prices and economic calculation are so important, is because they allow entrepreneurs to express their judgments about these different physical goods, again, in terms of this common denominator, the money price, which expresses the social value of these different combinations of assets, right? And once you have this common denominator, entrepreneurs are able to take this valuation, bring it into the marketplace, and actually use it to buy and to sell and to organize production in the effort to create something that's valuable for consumers, right? So once again, this is just emphasizing the importance of money prices and that monetary notion of capital, which allows you to express the social worth of all of these different heterogeneous capital goods. And so capital heterogeneity has long been one of the really important features of Austrian economics. And you see it in other areas as well, too, not just entrepreneurship proper, but for instance, it's a crucial idea in Austrian business cycle theory. When we talk about how entrepreneurs can commit resources to long-term production plans, and then suddenly when the bust comes, the bust phase of the business cycle, suddenly those production plans are rendered worthless, and valuable capital goods can't just instantaneously be switched into other lines of production because they're not all equally good for it. You can't just quickly and costlessly transform a car production plant to a computer production plant, right? Because you have these different physical goods and different entrepreneurs' estimates of how to use them together. So heterogeneity has for a very long time been a key theme in Austrian economics, precisely for this reason, because it helps us to explain all the different problems that entrepreneurs encounter when they're facing, for instance, a dynamic economy.
So are we living in a special age of heterogeneous capital, Matt, where I can download some of those capital goods from the internet? I can get my computing power from AWS, I can set up a storefront on Amazon.com, or I can set up my own storefront on Shopify or using that kind of capital goods. Is it easier than ever to assemble my heterogeneous capital? Is that a nature of this age?
In a sense, yes, because, for instance, talking about digitization, it has made a lot of older physical capital goods assets unnecessary, or at least has transformed the way that we use them. Perhaps in older times, we might have had to build those assets ourselves, or we might have had to actually own them outright. Whereas now, with digitization and online platforms for all of these kind of assets, it has become so much easier to simply rent an asset rather than own it, or it's become much easier to maybe even download it for free, right? Some piece of knowledge that used to cost much more. So at the very least, being able to swap cheap digital assets for expensive physical assets has made it, has greatly lowered the barriers to becoming an entrepreneur and has lowered some of the requirements, maybe some of the traditional capital requirements to get into different lines of business, especially in these areas where old physical technology has been in some way replaced by digital technology.
You mentioned the rent versus own question. In our thinking about capital, how should our entrepreneurs think about managing that? So if we can rent that computing power as opposed to own it, It still can be generating some future flows from consumers for me. Can we help entrepreneurs think about the rent versus own on capital?
Yes, we can. And first, I mean, there's a more obvious point, which is that we can look directly to the pricing issue, right? Obviously, it's cheaper in the short run to rent an asset rather than to own it because you don't have to pay full price for it, right? So you have these very basic issues that play into sort of business decision making. The underlying Austrian point there is that we have a really good explanation of how those rental and purchase prices come to be, right? We know that they are, you know, the capitalized value of all the future rents and value produced by these assets, you know, pumped in the present, discounted to the present. That's a unique Austrian view of how the value of those assets comes to be. So we can help entrepreneurs just by encouraging them to look more closely at how those prices are formed and the things that are going to encourage them to change, right? Because as rental prices or purchase prices change over time, it becomes, you know, looking at them relative to each other, it makes more or less sense to buy or to own an asset, right? So by encouraging people to look at consumers and imputation and the way that value and price formation happens in an Austrian sense, we give people a better basis for thinking about how to make those decisions in the future. Because I would like to think at least have a better idea of the fundamental causes behind all of those things. Right? So that's, I think, one way to look at it as well. Another issue that comes up a lot in this notion of sort of rent or buy is the amount of control that an entrepreneur retains. Now, some people think, and I would argue that this is mistaken, that these days nobody really needs to own any assets. Everything can just be sort of rented or borrowed from somebody else. But to me, this overlooks a really crucial aspect of entrepreneurship, which is the importance of retaining the ultimate control over your business. Because if all you do is rent assets from other businesses and you don't actually own them, then at the end of the day, you're really not in complete control over your business. You're not the ultimate decision maker. It's the people who actually own your assets. In a way, you're almost like a manager for somebody else who's entrusting you with control of what is ultimately their business. So this is another important thing that I think the Austrian view of the entrepreneur and of capital has to add, is helping people think more about just what they really own and what they really control in a business.
Yeah, interesting point. Well, I'm just going to wrap up the two-part question, Matt, which is bad practice, but I'll ask you to deal with it. Going back to the beginning where we talked about metaphors for capital, like human capital and brand capital, reputation capital, those kinds of things. That's potentially sloppy thinking about capital. So I might ask you to explain that. And then the second part of the question would be, what's the benefit to the entrepreneur of the more rigorous and precise definition of capital that you have given us today as the Austrian definition? And why does that help them?
To the first part of the question, metaphors have for a long time been quite troublesome in economics. We use them all the time, of course, because they're linguistically easy. It helps us in our sometimes they can help us in pedagogical ways. Either, you know, it's easy to use a metaphor like the invisible hand to convey ideas about market coordination and so forth, than it sometimes is to actually walk step by step through every detail of the theory. So that's why we start to use metaphors. But the problem with metaphors is that they lend themselves very easily to abuse. And this is what has happened with the capital concept, because it started with concepts like human capital, which are a little more reasonable. You know, you can understand why maybe a certain type of education would increase your productivity and increase your lifetime income. So you can understand a little bit why people would make the analogy to capital there, right? But of course, it hasn't stopped there, and it's at this point really degenerated into all of these dozens and dozens of other metaphorical capital concepts, none of which really add to our understanding of anything in the world. They're really just multiplying concepts for its own sake, or rather for the sake of academics who want to publish more papers by inventing new terminology. So that to me is one of the great risks with a lot of these other capital metaphors, is that they don't add anything to our thinking. And in fact, they take something away from it by just further clouding this whole issue about what capital is, what it does, and what it means in any kind of concrete economic terms. And that leads me to the second part of your question, which is, you know, at the end of the day, what does the, you know, who cares? Why should we worry about this? And I think the answer there is that the monetary value view of capital that the Austrians use is the easiest and most realistic way to connect a lot of different parts of the entrepreneurial process. By thinking about capital, it allows us to look at consumers, businesses, B2B businesses, you know, all the way up through from the consumers, all the way up through the value chain. And it allows us to look at what unites them and what unites all of their individual valuation, which are ultimately expressed in terms of money prices. And then when you sum up the, you know, these various prices, these income streams, when you put those together, you get a view of, you know, the total value of the business. So this to me is a very elegant way of looking at the process. So this is, for me, is a crucial reason why it's important to continue to think about the Austrian theory of capital. And then, of course, there's the point that I mentioned before also about heterogeneity and thinking about capital goods, because that's also a crucial way of thinking about how entrepreneurial decisions work in practice, especially in very difficult situations like the business cycle, where you have sudden disasters that people don't see coming, and the sudden, you know, business failures and the sudden need to really transform and revolutionize a business, and the various challenges that are involved in that. So here with the two sides of capital, I would suggest are two different reasons why it's worth going back to the Austrians and taking them seriously.
Very good. That's actually a beautiful vision, I think, of thinking about what unites everything in the value chain to result in those value flows and that calculation of value. So Matt, let me thank you very much for today. That was tremendously enlightening and hopefully very helpful for our entrepreneurial listeners. So let me thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.